Welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. We are a vibrant international community for those who have questions or doubts about their faith. On these podcasts, we talk to guests who have experienced harm from extreme religious beliefs, as well as experts who offer help, hope, and healing. And sometimes these people are one and the same. I am your host, Tim Reimel, along with my co-host, Bill Prickett.
Hey, Bill.
Hey, Tim. How's it going?
It is going quite well. How are you doing?
I'm doing really, really well. It's crazy Texas weather. Earlier this week, we were in the 30s. Yesterday, we were 80. It's always an adventure with Texas weather.
Well, I think our fires are finally out in California.
Well, yeah, I was seeing all your pictures of the smoke in your area and not being able to walk your dog. It's just a horrible situation, and just watching you guys deal with it as well.
Yeah, it was crazy here in Sacramento because the smoke was so bad and we kept looking at our phones to see how unhealthy the weather was for that day. And it was crazy as my parents live about 25 miles away. So it was bad in my area and it was worse in their area. We were all pretty much trapped inside our houses for a couple of weeks.
Wow. I was living in Southern California during the Laguna fires, but I was in Orange County. I was in Newport Beach, and of course, Laguna was south of us. And the fires, we could see the fires and the smoke, but it wasn't blowing our direction. So in your situation, I mean, does it get into your house, or how do you keep it out?
It does get into our house, but Sacramento is a valley.
Anything
that happens north of us or surrounding us, it always comes into Sacramento. And I forgot how many acres it burned, 150,000 acres or something. I don't know what it was, but it was, I know we lost almost 14,000 homes and 800 businesses. A lot of people are homeless, and there's still a lot of people looking for places to go. I know our neighbor said she was thinking of taking someone in, and friends were taking people in. So it got really crazy out here. It's funny seeing the look on my dog's face, because we get up every morning and we go for a walk, and he would get up and he would look at me and he was all excited. And then I would just watch his ears go down and his tail go down. And I had to explain to him that the weather wasn't good enough. He didn't get it.
He didn't get it. No, I mean, I can't imagine, because the Laguna fires were not as big. They were pretty destructive, but not as big. I was living in Orange County for the Laguna fires and one of the major Malibu mudslides, and also for the Northridge earthquake. So I hope I'm not the common denominator in all of those, but it was devastating driving down to all these places that I knew down in Laguna after the fire.
Yes, and I've only seen pictures on TV. Fortunately, we are about 100, 150 miles away from what actually happened, but it was quite devastating.
Well, I'm glad you're doing well.
Thank you. So let's talk about who's on our show today. Our guest is John Smid, whom actor and director Joel Edgerton described in the LA Times recently as warm, articulate, charismatic, somewhere right between an alpha and a beta male and a leader. John is currently being portrayed in the movie Boy Erased by Edgerton as the fictitious leader Victor Sykes of the real ex-gay ministry, now defunct, Love in Action, where John was the executive director for 18 years. John was recently described as the Elvis of ex-gay ministry in one of the best interviews I've ever heard him give on the podcast Unerased. It is sincere, honest, vulnerable, and heartfelt, and you can download that episode, which is episode 4, from wherever you listen to your podcast. So again, it is called Unerased. Now, I've known John for almost 30 years. For 6 of those, he was my boss at Love in Action, and then independently, we started the deconversion process. And John came out as a gay man in 2012, and is now married to a dude. John spends his time working to end conversion therapy now. So John is the author of X'd Out, How I Fired the Shame Committee, where he shares his story of getting out of ex-gay ministry and rethinking his faith. John, welcome to our show.
Hi there, Tim. Hi, Bill.
Hey, John. So good to have you with us. I have to throw in my part because, I mean, Tim's known you for 30 years. I haven't known you as long. You and I didn't meet till after you started your coming out process. But as I've told you in the past, you were on my radar before that. Let me, since Tim mentioned the movie, Boy Erased, Tim and I have done a podcast on it. And if you haven't heard the podcast, anybody listening, it is in our list. It's a quickie pod on Boy Erased, and Tim and I talk about the movie. And since you are sort of portrayed in the movie, I know that you're getting a lot of feedback and pushback. I have basically just a couple of questions, because we're not here to discuss the movie again, but I have a couple of questions that just were in my mind that I'd like to ask you personally. The first is, when you think about the movie and when you see the movie, what did they get wrong?
You know, that's a challenging question, because the movie itself is a very strong message that is really pertinent for today. The message in the movie about conversion therapy and families that have mm-hmm. a gay child or a gay loved one, and the challenges that Garrett's family faced and the way that they dealt with it, which were conveyed in the movie. I just think it's such a pertinent message. It's hard for me to say what they got wrong in the movie.
Okay.
Because I understand the movie as a composite. The director himself has said that it's a composite of stories that he's heard, that people have shared with him, that he put into the content of the movie. And so when I first saw the film, my observation was, as I actually spoke to Joel right after the movie, I said, "Joel, what I think about the movie, my immediate response is, you've changed the names, but the stories are true. Those things really have happened to many people." Of course, people want to ask me, well, is that really you? You know, is Victor Sykes really you? Well, first of all, Victor Sykes in the film plays the role of a senior counselor and director of the Ministry of Love and Action. I was never a senior counselor. Counseling was not my forte. That's not my education. That's not really what I did, especially during the time the film took place. We had full-time counselors on staff. We called them staff workers, and the staff workers were the ones that did the one-on-one counseling. So, you know, I was never that person. I didn't lead the intensive processing groups. The counselors led those groups. And so when I watched the film, that would be one of the first things I would have said is, I was a speaker, a teacher, I was the executive director of the ministry, and those are the roles that I played.
Right. And I recognized the composite nature of it. And as I sat and watched it, my husband kept leaning over and saying, "Did that really happen? Did they do stuff like that?" And so it was constantly me saying, "Well, yes, probably." And, you know, because I had heard some of the same stories as well.
Yeah.
In thinking about the movie, what do you wish they had included that maybe wasn't there?
In the context of that film, I'm not sure there was anything else they could have put in it. But the truth of conversion therapy is that Love in Action was one organization that was residential in terms of the model. That was not the norm for conversion therapy. We were unusual. We were unique. I think at the peak of the Exodus International history, there may have been three or four residential ministries across the nation out of the 120 that were on the list. So the truth is that conversion therapy is most often, has been most often led by people who are significantly untrained
mm-hmm.
lay workers.
Right.
Most of Exodus ministries were led by people who just had a burden to help people. And so they would lead support groups, discussion groups, book studies, and they also would do one-on-one sessions with many of the people who had come to their groups. These were people that were not in it full-time. Many of them had other jobs, and yet they were digging into the hearts of men and women in very deep and tender places, having absolutely no expertise or no training or education to do that.
Yes, and that's in the decades that I've observed and monitored and written about ex-gays, and escape programs. That's the one of the two things that stood out to me, is that it is to a large degree people without the necessary training. It's not that they have no training. They may have some theology. They may have some pastoral counseling, but not the significant kind. And the second thing that I've always noticed for many of these ministries is they're led by people who have their own struggles. They either feel that they've found something that has helped them to overcome, and so they've started a group kind of around that. So you have these people who are, they've had their own struggles. They're helping people also with struggles.
And to my regret, we at times would invite people to come to one of our conferences or one of our family and friends weekends from other ministries, and they would see what we did, and they would at times ask us how to facilitate some of the tools that we used, and they would take them back and use them in their own ministries. And when I say my regret, it's like, I think as a Christian organization, during those years, we had a sense of entitlement to do whatever we wanted to do because God asked us to do it.
Yes.
And so we were not subject to the traditional ethics, traditional training, traditional expertise, because there wasn't any. The American Psychological Association, American Psychiatric Association completely removed homosexuality from the DSM-3. There was no professional training from those professional organizations to counsel people away from homosexuality.
Yeah, and there's no oversight on methodology, and so you have a group in a small town in Kansas doing one thing, and you have a group in a small town in Kentucky doing something totally different, and they're convinced this is how you, quote, cure homosexuality, and somebody else is doing something different. And one of the first things that struck me before I began to leave all of this is there was no clear explanation of how somebody becomes a homosexual. So there was no clear methodology on how to fix it. And it was just all over the place.
And I would often say, we don't have those answers. I made it very clear when someone would ask me, do you think someone is born gay? I would say, we don't know. There is no answer for that. But we would always back that up with, but we know what God says about it.
Yes, that's the foundational presupposition.
Absolutely. We were certain. We were absolutely certain that we knew what God wanted to do about it. And so many of these organizations would do what they did under what many would call biblical counseling.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe another area that this happens is in a pastor's office. My husband didn't go through any professional or therapy. He didn't go through any ex-gay ministry, but he was counseled by his pastor, who told him he should try and date women, who told him he should avail himself to learning how to be more masculine. His pastor gave him that traditional line, which was equally as damaging and wounding. And so all of these organizations and all these pastors across the country are communicating a message to gay people, who are most of whom faith-based people. These are not typically non-church people. These are all church people. And when you picture all of these church-oriented, faith-based oriented people who are burdened about their sexuality, they go to their trusted authority, who would be their pastor, their Sunday school teacher, their biblical counselor at their church. And immediately we get hit with shame, with an impossible goal, with dysfunctional counseling about their lives. I talked with a man just the other day that went through Love in Action about 15 years ago. And he said, John, I am still trying to sort all this out. This has been a very, very difficult road. But one of the first things a counselor in my church told me was that my issues had nothing to do with my childhood sexual abuse, but they were rather because I was gay. And so my counselors completely circumvented the most significant things I needed help with and went straight to the gay issue. And I mean, these kinds of things are just appalling.
Well, then I think you hit on something. I know Tim had some questions for you, and I don't want to belabor this point, but you hit on something that I think is very, very important for people to understand. You said we may not know what causes it. We may have differing opinions on how to fix it, but we knew what God said about it. And it was that presupposition. We know what God says about homosexuality.
Yeah.
So no matter what other information is given to us, whatever else we're confronted with that may contradict that, we can ignore it because we know what God said.
Yes. And, right, and for me, the difficulty in that, Bill, is one of the most overwhelming things that I recognized in about 2010, I was away from Love in Action about 2 years, is the notion that we don't know what God says about it, because every unique and different denomination, version of the Bible, culture, they all have different answers. And so what I thought was an absolute for all those years that I functioned under, I recognized at that point, there is no absolute, there is no certainty about what many of these passages say. And yet, yes. in my arrogant time in life, I had the answer. I knew absolutely.
Right.
And it wasn't true.
And nobody could tell us differently back then.
Right. No, I wouldn't listen.
Mm. Well, you know, I think that's a perfect segue, because I've always said that conversion therapy is the tip of the iceberg when we talk about evangelical Christianity, because, you know, and John, you and I have talked about this before, is that you now see somebody on television or you hear somebody giving this evangelical message and you think, oh my God, was that me? Is that what I sounded like? Yeah. But it's because we knew for sure, right? We knew that whatever it was that we believed was absolutely true, and we felt compelled to go out and give this message and tell other people how they should be living too.
Yes. I had an experience recently. I had two experiences. One was to hear myself on an old teaching tape that was put on a podcast, and I heard the things I said and my words, and I had to almost say, oh my gosh, was that really me? Was that really me? You know? The second thing that struck me was there is a white paper that has been written. It's in the archives at the Smithsonian Institute. It's with the Medicine Society. And the white paper discusses a time in my life when Love in Action was going through a huge evaluation process with the protests and the legal matters and all kinds of stuff back in 2006, 2007, in those years. And I read documents that I wrote during that time, and I have to say, I was almost, I have not ever been truly what I would call clinically depressed, but I will tell you, for about 2 to 3 days, I was close, because when I read what I had written and I saw the truth, this was a paper written by 27 lawyers. I mean, it was documented to the hilt. It had every T crossed and every I dotted. It was absolute truth. I could not deny. It wasn't subject to a commentator. It was facts. It was right in front of my eyes. And I was so humiliated by the things I had said, because it was rooted in that Christian entitlement.
What was the process that you went through in your deconversion? What finally broke you from being so rigid in your belief system?
Well, first of all, I'll do a plug for my book, Exed Out, EXDOUT, Exed Out. My book chronicles a period of time from 2005 through 2012, which shows a process of knowledge, of awareness, of discovery that led me through those years closer to the place where I am today. But the first thing that hit me, the very first thing I remember, was an introduction to a man named Michael Bussey. Michael Bussey is known as being one of the original participants in the founding of Exodus International. He was one of the people that helped to orchestrate one of the first Exodus conferences. And through my time at Love in Action for those 20 years, I heard numerous times what a terrible, rebellious, unrepentant man Michael Bussey was. It was not uncommon at all to hear his name brought up in very derogatory and negative ways because he backslid. He went away from the community and the culture, and he was with a man, and it was just all these terrible things. And so I was confronted by that from a good friend of mine who said, "Well, John, have you ever met Michael Bussey?" And I said, "No, I've never met him." "Well, would you like to meet him? Because he's a personal friend of mine." And of course, I kind of shrunk behind the curtain on that one. I thought, "Uh-oh, she knows him," because I had been ragging on him. I was carrying on that message. And so she orchestrated a phone call. When I spoke with Michael, he was the antithesis of all those things I had heard him to be. And it shocked me to find that the reputation that had been given me was out of bitterness, out of resentment, out of control, and not out of true, honest evaluation of who this person was. And I discovered he was kind, he was patient, he was loving, he was a man of faith, he was humble and endearing. And I walked away from that conversation asking myself, "Oh my gosh, how else have I been given a false message?" And that was an initial turning point for me. That was a major shift when I first started to ask questions about my past and say, "What else have I been duped in? How many other things have I heard that are lies?"
And you were ordained as a Baptist minister, is that correct?
I was licensed under a Southern Baptist church in Memphis.
What did you have to say that you believed, and did you believe it when you got licensed?
I went through an interview process with an interview team where I had to do extensive questions and evaluations about what I believed. And at that time, it was, I don't remember, to be honest, but there's no question it had to do with just having a standard Baptist evangelical theology, probably some questions about the ministry that I did. And then they had to be confirmed and they had to vote to accept my license.
So you didn't come out of evangelicalism, though. Weren't you raised Catholic?
I was raised Catholic until I was about 19 years old, when I became old enough to make my own decisions, of course, at 19. So I stopped going to church, and I didn't go back until I was 30. And at that point, I was introduced to an Assembly of God church by a friend of mine. And that was my re-entry into a church practice and a church-going lifestyle.
And then you got sucked into it.
Well, I would not say I got sucked into it, because that sounds like a lure. And yet it was a lure, because what drew me to it was someone telling me that the answer to all of my difficulties was to repent of homosexuality and to embrace a biblical truth, and that would bring me joy, and that would bring me worth and value, and it would answer my questions. And so I chose to enter the church culture. And my first meeting with the singles pastor at that time, I went in and told him my story. And he said, "Well, let's read out of Romans chapter 1. And he wrote about, you know, the terrible nature of homosexuality. And I bought it because he was a man of God. He was a pastor. He was an authority. And who can argue with the Bible? I mean, for crying out loud. I didn't even know the Bible. But he was quoting it to me, and I believed him because I believed the Bible was an authority that I needed to believe and follow. And so I took that message to mean I had to leave it all. And I left my homosexual partner and at the time, and I never spoke again to my homosexual friends. And I just cut it all off and put it behind me and dove right headlong into Christian culture.
At what point did you marry your first wife?
When I was 19.
And you had two daughters. And didn't you leave her for a gay relationship?
At 6 years in our marriage, along with many other challenges that I was feeling inside about the marriage, I discovered that I was gay. In all truth, I really discovered it, because I was sexually very naive and a virgin when we married. I didn't have an adolescence where I explored my sexuality. And so my first wife and my first honeymoon night, I was my first exposure to any physical contact with another person. And so after about 6 years, I started looking around and evaluating. And finally, I spoke with a man that I knew was gay. And I thought, "Oh my gosh, that's really what it is. I'm a gay man." And that's why many of these challenges and difficulties are the way they are in my life. So I left my wife very quickly and began to explore the homosexual culture and my identity. At that point, I was, 25 years old.
I think one of the most heartbreaking things that you have talked about, and I know we've talked about this privately, was that when you got to Love in Action, you were told that you couldn't be a good enough father because you were gay.
Well, in honesty, I don't want to say that I was told that, but I definitely felt that. I felt that coming from what I was now understanding about homosexuality and faith and God and the Bible and culture and all those things. I looked at my life and I said, I really want more than anything to be a person of integrity. And I want to be a father that my children can respect. And I can't do that if I'm gay, because gay people are not people of integrity and they're not people that people respect.
Right. I'm going to step in for a minute. We're going to take a short break and tell the folks listening about the organization that we work with. And we'll be back in about 30 seconds.
Recovering from Religion is funded by those who believe in what we do. We invite you to support us with a monthly or one-time donation. Go to our website, recoveringfromreligion.org, and click on the donate button for instructions. On the website, you'll also find an extensive database of resources, including links, articles, and videos. We offer 24-hour phone and chat line support, along with the links to meetup groups in 20 communities around the U.S. With our secular therapy project, we can connect you with a professional who offers evidence-based, non-religious treatment. Our partner therapists understand the complexities of rethinking or leaving your faith. Finally, Recovering from Religion is an entirely volunteer-run organization. If you're interested in being a volunteer with us, please visit recoveringfromreligion.org and look for the volunteer tab.
John, when you first went into church, you said it was a whole new environment for you, and you talked to this singles pastor, and you pretty much told them what your life was like at that time. Is that how I understood you?
Yes, yes.
Is that how they told you about programs and ministries that could help you overcome this?
Well, they didn't actually do that. I was in that church and in the singles ministry very, very involved, and I was a leader, and I actually had a wonderful time during those 2 years. But I never knew another person that was wrestling with this issue, and I had not known of any information at all until I met a guy that was in our ministry, another young single guy that he and I developed a friendship, and through our discussions, I found that he was also gay. And because at the time I wanted to somehow help him and help me, and so I was hungry for something, for some kind of information. And in late 1986, I heard a Focus on the Family broadcast with a lady named Barbara Johnson, and she was talking about her son who was gay and her books for parents, and they gave me an address at the end I could send a letter to. And so I sent a letter to Focus on the Family and found out about Love in Action and Exodus at that point. And so I was very excited to find out, oh my gosh, there's someone who knows how to deal with this, someone who knows what they're doing. So I quickly did send a letter to them, and that ended up with a response back from Love in Action asking me if I wanted to be a house manager in their ministry. And I want to qualify that by saying I didn't receive any information. I didn't receive a letter. I had never met these people, but I received a phone call from Anita Worthen, the wife of the executive director. And the conversation started out with, "We received your letter," which was two paragraphs. "We want to know if you'd like to be a house leader for our ministry."
You know, that's funny, because in the Christian culture, we do that so often in churches and other organizations that I've been involved with, is we put people in charge without knowing anything about them, whether they're qualified, whatever, what their levels of maturity are. I've seen that so often in churches that I've been involved with. Somebody comes in and they're maybe enthusiastic, or maybe they're personable or charismatic, whatever, and we just hand them something and say, "Here, lead this." So that's interesting.
They did some homework. I mean, they wanted reference letters and those kinds of things. And so they did do some research, and I got great references from my pastor and other people. But for me, the other component of this, if we're talking about recovering from religion, the interesting component about this is every detail that I needed to engage my decision to move to California, 1,500 miles away, away from everything I'd always known, to work for Love in Action, every detail came together without any work on my part. I sold my house. I sold my personal belongings. I quit my job of 13 years and was paid a ton of money. It was a buyout that was happening at the railroad. All these details came into place, and I went from October, when Anita called me, to December, when I drove out of my driveway to move to California. In those 2.5 months, every detail came together, and I easily shared at the time, this must be God.
Well, absolutely. That's how we perceive things.
And I still look back upon that time, and I'm thinking, how did this happen? How did this happen so easily and so quickly? And when I got to Love in Action, I was relishing in the amazing experience of being in full-time ministry and working at Love in Action and helping these people and running this house. And I thought I had died and gone to heaven. I mean, it was a perfect scenario for me. Little did I know that that was the beginning of the loss of my connection to my daughters. Hmm. Remember, my motive was to be a good dad. Ex-gay ministry robbed me of 20 years with my daughters. And so in the end, what I desired was the antithesis of what I got. And I have spent the last, I don't know how many years, trying to reconcile some kind of a relationship with them.
It's interesting, though, how we interpret those things that happen to us. You know, and I always say, when you're, whatever your belief system is, it really defines everything that you do. It defines who you marry. It defines where you go to church. It defines how you vote. And it's difficult to break out of a belief system that you feel is so true that you've given yourself to it. We acquiesce to these feelings of belief, and we acquiesce to these circumstances that seem so divine.
Yeah.
And when you step away from that, there is a process of trying to put everything that happened in context. What has that process been like for you? How do you see your past now?
Well, I think part of it is those years for me were not wasted. I was a wounded person from my childhood. I had a lot of things that happened in my childhood that were extremely painful. And those years at Love in Action afforded me an opportunity to certain information and experiences where I did mature, and I was able to heal a lot of those things that had happened to me. And I used to say I was in the 20-year program. I didn't go through the 3-month or the 1 year. I went through the 20-year program. So in some ways, I see value in those years. But I also wonder if I had not gone to Love in Action, if maybe I had found another avenue to heal those things. There may have been a good, decent, gay-affirming counselor that could have helped me. I really feel as though religion and conservative evangelicalism did in many ways sideswipe my life. And that's a place where I'm at right now, is I'm really trying to wrestle through my anger towards evangelical Christianity.
That's one of the things you and I talked about before. And in fact, you let me use an example in my book about you going to a therapist and talking, and the therapist says, what are you angry about? And you said, well, I don't know. There's really nothing to be angry about. And I think in the context, if I remember this correctly, is he put the chair in front of you, similar to the chair that went in front of Jared in the movie, and asked you to express your anger. And it finally came out of you. You finally realized how hurt you were, how angry you were at the founders and all the people that you had talked to. What has that process been like for you in the last few years?
That was the first time that I have ever expressed rage in my life. And it just came out of seemingly nowhere, but I know it came out of my soul. And I think since then, I've recognized that there could be people that are that angry with me, and that I could be that target. I can be the person that unlocks that kind of rage and anger for someone. And so that allows me to be more gracious with people who are struggling, that have been through conversion therapy or who have been through Love in Action. It's like, hey, I get it. I get it. And if I'm the target, I'm the target. I'm a big boy. I can handle it. You just need to get over this. You need to get through this. You need to work this out. Express it however you need to. You got to lance that wound. And if it comes out at me, it comes out at me. And that's partly how I've responded to Garrod's book and to this movie. When I first read Garrod's book, I didn't like it. I didn't like what he'd written. I didn't like the stories he told that may not have all been totally factual. But I stood back and I said, look, Garrod needs whatever he needs to get through this. And I need to afford him that opportunity. I don't need to be liked by Garrod. Garrod needs to be healthy and he needs to work this out. And so it's afforded me a lot more patience. That particular counseling situation for me was a group counseling as well as some individual work. And I went to several follow-up meetings. And in one of those meetings, it modeled the things that we used at Love in Action. They used similar tools. They used similar modalities. And I'm sitting in this group and they're asking me to write my timeline, to talk about my feelings during the timeline. I thought, oh my goodness, we did that at Love in Action. And I started writing it out and I just started to become really, really frustrated because they were trying to tell me I had feelings I didn't have. They were saying, well, aren't you angry at your timeline? No, I've dealt with this. I've dealt with this timeline for 20 years. This is just in my head now. I've already gone through this. Oh, well, I'm sure you have feelings. And I walked away and I thought, oh my goodness, you know, in our desire to help, we probably did this at Love in Action. It's no wonder Garrod was angry because it brings stuff up. And for me, I walked out of there and I never went back. But it gave me an opportunity to vicariously feel what people may have felt at Love in Action. And so that's another experience where I'm able to stand back and have a little bit of common ground. It's like, I get it.
One of the things I've always appreciated about you and Michael Bussey that you mentioned earlier is your willingness to let survivors say what they need to say. We have to be the target of it. And I've always appreciated the way that you do handle that with grace.
John, let me ask you this, though. I don't want to just focus on the people that have been hurt, and not to give you an excuse. I know that you've been the target of and will continue to be the target of a lot of anger from a lot of people on both sides of this issue. What about you? What about John Smith? Where is the anger that you feel now? You mentioned that you still feel angry towards God or the evangelical movement. How are you processing?
I think honestly, Tim, some of it has to do with it connects to me. It connects to where I was. I'm angry at who I was. I'm angry at the representation of that in a church or a experience that I see today. An example of that was the whole political game within church organizations, the manipulation for fundraising and the, well, we need to have this because we're doing God's work, and the entitlement and the business building of it all. And that stuff to me is something that I lived in for so many years. And as I read that white paper, there was a fundraising letter in there. And I look back and realize we used that legal situation to try to get more money. We emphasized the struggle we were going through in the hopes people would send us more money. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, that's what I see on televangelists and other places, and the lying and deception just to get more money. And I feel so humiliated and embarrassed that I was even close to that at that point. I look back at the rationale of giving lessons or teachings on Bible passages that I didn't even understand. And so I thought, how many times are we given some kind of religious platitude or some kind of religious answer that doesn't make sense? It doesn't fly with our brains and our intellect and our God-given soul. It doesn't work, and yet we're taught that that's what we're supposed to believe. And if we don't believe it, then we're rebellious. One of the last house churches I was a part of, I started questioning things that where I was allowing to come up. It's like, I have a question. And I threw a question out there And you would have thought I threw a stink bomb in the middle of the room. I mean, these people about danced a jig around my question. They didn't know what to do with it. And eventually they disfellowshipped me. They kicked me out. Two men came and met with me and said, "You're disfellowshipped, you're rebellious, you're a false teacher, and we can no longer have anything to do with you." And it's at that time in my life, I did not have any conclusions about homosexuality or anything. I was just asking questions. And so I thought, man, this is just like what I always believed a cult is. And so I look at it now and realize that in my thinking today, where I'm at, a lot of evangelical Christianity has cult-like symptoms and sometimes full-fledged cult behavior. If you don't agree with us, if you don't believe what we're saying, then you're rebellious and you don't dare ask a question. And so it really does frustrate me, and I feel angry about being duped. I feel like I was duped by all of this.
I guess what I'm hearing is a little bit of shame, a little bit of anger. There's a lot of emotions in where John Smith fits into this versus what happened to you versus the beliefs that you see being proliferated by the movement. How do you sort all of that out?
You know, it's just a time process. It just has to work itself through. I don't think there's a timeline or a method. It just has to work its way through. And the way I work through things is through vocalizing where I'm at, through conversation, through sharing with other people and hearing myself process my attempt to reconcile with people who had been through Love in Action. I'm a reconciler at heart. I'm a peacemaker. And I went to three different men that I had homosexual relationships with my first time out in my 20s. I met with each one of those people, and I wanted to talk with them about where we had been and where I had come from and gone. And it was very reconciling. Those were some of the most significant God moments for me, are those serendipitous meetings that are just full of truth and peacemaking. And one of these men told me, he said, "John, there was nothing I could have told you back then. You were going the direction you were going. I didn't think it was right. I could see where you were headed into the whole ex-gay thing, but who was going to tell you?" It was like, oh my gosh, back in those years, I didn't even know he thought that. But he was smart enough to know where I was headed. But I was so determined that I was going to be the best person I could be. And that was the only way I thought I could do it. I've said this a couple times, which may mean that's part of my process right now as we're talking, is that part of my frustration and my anger is the loss of almost 30 years of my life. It wasn't all a wash, but I can only imagine where I may have gone and different decisions I would have made had I never gone down the path of evangelical Christianity. Mm-hmm. I lost relationships with family, my cousins, because they weren't evangelicals. They were Catholic. And so I had a judgment about their lack of faith and their wrong theology. And I found out later, after I came out, that they were like waiting in the wings for me to come back. They loved me. They loved me deeply. And I lost all those years with people who really loved me and cared for me, that weren't placing an agenda on me, that didn't have an expectation of behavior. They loved me unconditionally, and I missed years of being with those people.
It's been about 10 years since you walked away from Love in Action?
It's been 10 years this year, yes.
How do you live with yourself?
For me, there has to be a certain amount of denial. I have to ignore some of the feelings that I have, because my perception is I would be completely overwhelmed if I let it all come out. And so it has to just squeak out a little at a time, and sometimes more than others. And then I just kind of stuff it back away again and let it process inside. When I'm working in my shop or building furniture, I'm by myself when I do that, 40 hours a week, probably working in my shop. I'm thinking and processing. When I'm mowing the yard, we have 2 acres, and I get out there on the lawnmower and I have all kinds of process going on in my head when I'm mowing the yard. And I internally work it out, and then I talk it out with somebody. And it just gradually works itself through. But I don't know that I will ever deal with it all, Tim, honestly. I think it's just part of my life and history, and it's just going to be there. I don't have any visions of grandeur that I'm ever going to have that perfect person. I think I'm always going to be impacted by it. It's always going to be some rough spots in my armor, and I just have to live with that.
I think that's definitely right, because I've been out of the ex-gay movement for probably close to 30 years now. And there are still things that just hit me sometimes. When watching Boy Erased, there were things in there that, I mean, I just thought, I'm going to lose it here in the theater. And so there are these triggers and there are these reminders. And so it's always going to be a process. And I will occasionally hear old tapes from my fundamental background. There are things that will just pop up, and
yeah,
and not so much ex-gay, just the fundamental, just the dogma that we were taught. It's very, very difficult to completely overcome that. And I'm like you, I don't know that it's ever going to happen. It's a continued process of going through it.
The wonderful thing about today, in my experience, is that I have absolutely no certainty. I do not know anything for certain. I don't know where I've come from, and I don't know where I'm going when I die. I don't know who God is. I don't know where he is, or if it's a he or if it's not a he. I don't know what or who God is. And those are very uncomfortable things for me. But at the same time, it's the most honest and authentic place I've ever been in my life. And I can handle that. I'd rather have honesty and authenticity than to believe something that I'm really not certain about. And so it's comforting to be there, and it's also very disconcerting, because now I don't have this amazing hope for heaven that I based so many years on, because I don't even know if there is a heaven. And even during those years, as I look back, I realize that down inside, I didn't for sure know there was a heaven then either. But I couldn't allow myself to even ponder that, because the culture around me was so certain about their certainties that they couldn't handle my deeper questions. And so in that regard, I'm really at more peace today than I've ever been, even though when I die, I don't know where I'm going to go.
What are your relationships like today?
My relationships are still challenging. I really can't say that I know how to relate to people very well. I find myself more honest about that too. I've always seen myself as a real relational person, really caring about people and placing that high on my agenda. And I recognize now that I ignore people and I don't always jump out there to be the rescuer or the best person I can be. I miss the mark all the time. I look around and I find it's easy for me to say someone might be quirky when I look back at myself and say, you're one of the most quirky people I know, you know? And so I think I'm more in that deeper level of honesty. It's also uncomfortable because I think I'm more aware of the areas of shortcoming that I have and that there's no real answer to that. Whereas it used to be in the whole ex-gay evangelical world has this cloud in front of them that is supposed to be so absolute. You know, God is always making me better and he loves me more than to leave me where I was yesterday. And there's this hope for perfection and nirvana. And so a lot of evangelical experience for me was more focused on that cloud than real life right now. In today, being present, there lacked a sense of presence about life in that culture. Whereas now I'm learning to live more in the present than trying to put all my focus on the unknowns of the future.
What does it look like for you to live in absolute honesty?
Being honest with myself.
And what does that look like?
Being willing to evaluate, a willingness to see the flaws, a willingness to attempt to feel, which I'm not good at. I've always been told I was emotionally mature, but I'm really not. I can identify my feelings with words, but I'm really, really bad at feeling them. I can be kind of aloof some of that aloofness is a self-protection. I have a lot of wounds. I feel abandoned a lot. My family was a disaster. My sisters are both Jehovah's Witnesses, and they've both completely relationally severed. They didn't make any line in the sand, but there's no relationship. There's no initiation. There's no response from them. I've got an email hanging out there now to one of my sisters that she is not responding to. And so I feel abandoned by them. The closest people to me in my life, the two and three sisters that I went through some of the hardest times in my life with, are people that are inaccessible to me now, and yet they're not dead. So religion plays a role in that, but they won't tell me that. They won't be honest with me about the reason we're separated. It's because in their minds, their Jehovah's Witness friends have more significance to them than their brother. That's the way we live. That's what they're showing me. And so religion has wounded me on several different levels and has robbed from me significance. All of that swirls in me on a daily basis. I don't have perfect peace. I don't have perfect joy. I don't have this perfect place that I live. I struggle. I struggle a lot. And I have to find some way every day to just live the day that I live and experience it for what it is and enjoy those things that I can enjoy.
And I know you and Larry attend a church, a local church. It sounds like you have a lot of ambivalence towards religion in general.
Oh, yes, very much so. And the church we go to, the only reason that I can go there and participate in any kind of religious service is that it is a denomination called the Disciples of Christ, which is based on diversity. People that go there are diverse in their theology and in their process and in their history. We do not discuss religion amongst ourselves. Not like all the other churches I went to, that was the main conversation. At this church, the conversation is about cooking. It's about the latest thing I did. It's about our families. It's not about the Bible. It's not about theology. When I have a struggle or a question or a comment about my own theology, when I have brought that up to anyone in our church, from pastors all the way down to elders and deacons and other people, I have been met with nothing but grace, absolute grace and acceptance. They have never tried to change me, teach me, prop me up. None of them ever tried to make me a project. And so I can go there knowing that they know me. They know I'm in this place that I don't know what I believe. I don't know who God is. I can go there and still be loved and accepted. That's the only reason I can go there. I've been honest with them. I don't go there for the church service. That's the last of my worries. I go to the church service because there's people there that I feel loved by. So I'm willing to forego the church service. I'm willing to kind of ignore that and just hug on the necks of people that love me. So it's kind of strange. I go to a church not because it's a church. Actually, I wish it weren't a church. I'd rather it were something else, some kind of social club or something.
We have a dinner club, but we call it church.
Right.
Yeah. So I can go there for that. We got a new pastor recently, and he is a little bit more of a traditional Baptist type speaker on Sunday mornings. But he is very relational, very energized, and he's really, really good for that church. He's really a perfect match to help that church be what they want to be. And you notice I'm using that church and they, because I really don't like hearing those sermons on Sunday morning. And as a matter of fact, I've heard them all 100 times. There's nothing new. He's not saying anything new. He's not using any new analogies. I've heard it all. And it really doesn't mean a hill of beans to me.
One of the things that I just wanted to throw this in, because I find it so interesting. You're talking about this church and the diversity, and you were able to go there and be you. And it is a very, very small town in Texas. You're like an hour to not even 2 hours away from us here in Dallas. And there is that freedom there. I love that.
Well, there is, but it's the only church in Lamar County, which is our county, that will love a gay couple. They love Larry and I. They support us. The pastor sent us a happy anniversary card last week for our wedding anniversary. They don't say they're gay affirming, but they practice that. They do support us. Some of the people there don't believe in gay marriage. They're diverse. But there are many people who do. And so we can exist there. But in Lamar County, that is very, very rare. And most of the churches around here would not at all be warm to us being in their church. And they wouldn't send us an anniversary card for sure.
What is the future of John Smid? Where do you see yourself?
You know, Tim, I'm 65 this year. And frankly, I just want to live the rest of my life experiencing some sense of peace, not being overly involved in things that are extremely hectic. My relationship with Larry is, without any question, the most loving and accepting and encouraging relationship I have ever had with anyone in my life. I am a far better person with Larry in my life than I have ever been. Larry allows me the freedom to be who I am. There is no judgment. There is no criticism. When something needs to be said, he'll say it. But other than that, I find a tremendous amount of grace in this relationship. So enjoying that is a major component of the rest of my life. I would love to see a continued growth in my relationship with my two daughters and my grandkids that is on a progression to getting better a little at a time. I do hope that that will continue to grow. It'd be great if we could find a place where we could find some gay friends, but where we live, we just really don't have any people we hang out with. There's one guy that I kind of know as a friend, but it's hard here to find that. So we actually, most of our social circle is people that are 80 years old, 75 and 80 years old. And that's not an exaggeration. That's true. Those are people at our church. So I don't know, you know, Larry's family is moving on. His parents are getting older and we live right around the corner from them. I'm sure we'll be spending more and more time over the years helping them with their life. You know, I live out in the prairie. I guess what I'm saying is I just want to find some kind of relaxation and peace for the rest of my life.
And that's one of the things I wish for you, because you have been in the spotlight off and on for so long. I mean, your wedding, your marriage to Larry made national news. I mean, for heaven's sakes, it was like, holy crap, who wants their wedding? I mean, unless you're the Kardashians, who wants their wedding national?
I don't mind that. I want to make a difference. I don't want to just slink into the background. If I said someone earlier today, I said, I respond. Next week, I have two people coming. The Dallas Morning News is coming, and a couple of kids from White Ride High School are coming to interview me. I don't mind doing that. I want to make a difference. I want people to know there's hope. I've always wanted to do that. I just don't go looking for it.
Well, and I understand, but you know, I do wish for you peace because I love you. I love your husband. You're just very special to me. I want people to know how to find you. You have a website. I want people to be able to see the furniture that you make because it's incredible. So tell people how to find you and your sites.
Yes, you can go to gracerivers.com for a lot of information that I have out there. And certainly on Facebook. I don't make myself private. People can find me on Facebook and they can send me messages. If you're interested in J&L Creative Design, which is our furniture business, you can find that on website as well, on Facebook as well. That's what I spend most of my time doing is building furniture. So I love it. It's creative and it is a relaxing thing I get to do.
And we'll post those links in the show notes for the podcast if anybody wants to look for those.
Yeah, we can get those out there.
Thanks.
And don't forget the book, X'd Out, How I Fired the Shame Committee, which is available on Amazon. John, I just want to say that, you know, I've known you all these years. I absolutely love you. I'm so impressed with you. I've always been impressed with you and your humility and who you are as a human being. So thank you for being my friend and thank you for being on our show.
Yes. Thanks, John.
I love both of you guys.
Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
This podcast is one part of Recovering from Religion. We invite you to visit our website at recoveringfromreligion.org. to find other valuable resources and to make a donation that will support all the work we do here. If you have questions for either of us, or if you have suggestions for a future topic, or if you think you'd like to be a guest on a show, tell us about that in an email at podcast@recoveringfromreligion.org. Again, thanks for listening to this episode of the Recovering from Religion podcast.